Welcome to Recovery Radio by Landmark Recovery with your host, Zach Crouch. In this program, we'll discuss the root causes and treatments of alcohol and substance addiction, speak with experts in related fields, and help navigate the road to recovery. Now, here's the host of Recovery Radio, Zach Crouch.
Welcome back, everyone. I want to kick off today's conversation with a quote, just as an encouragement and inspiration for anyone struggling with mental health, addiction, or the journey that is recovery. And this comes from Shannon Alder. And I love this. It says, "Before you can live, a part of you has to die. You have to let go of what you could have been, how you should have acted, and what you wish you would have said differently. You have to accept that you can't change the past experiences, opinions of others at that moment in time, or outcomes from their choices or yours. From this point, you will finally be free." It's a powerful reminder. Michael, what are we going to be discussing today?
Well, good morning, Zach. Today, we're going to actually be continuing that discussion that we had a couple of weeks ago with Dr. Kirby. About treating substance use disorders with medication. So this is a part two, if you will, and really trying to go from the medical piece that we talked about with Dr. Kirby to the clinical piece with Michelle Duby, who's our chief clinical officer at Landmark Recovery. And, hopefully the listeners have heard the interview with Dr. Kirby. If you haven't, check it out. He's a really great, I was really pleased to meet him. Great interview. Just reminded me of one of the doctors I met years ago. I met this doc at a conference, and we had a conversation at 7 in the morning over coffee. And at one point I said to him, I don't want to insult you, but, you seem to be a really good guy for a physician. And he said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, you're just a regular guy, he said, "I've been a recovering alcoholic a lot longer than I've been a physician." this was a 45-year-old guy at the time who'd gotten sober as a teenager and clean as a teenager, and then went to high school, college, medical school, and I felt that way talking to Dr. Kirby. You would just not even know that he was as smart as he is because he dumbed down the conversation for you and I.
Well, and that's what I loved about it too, is that it makes it so approachable to talk about this stuff, because this can. It could be sort of intimidating, confusing, all things kind of combined sometimes. So, and that's the reason we're having this episode, really, because we didn't want to give the impression that we could possibly cover the topic of medication-assisted treatment in one conversation, right, Mike?
Huge subject.
Today, it was really important for us to bring in another expert, who I've known for a long time now. It's hard to believe, Michelle. It's almost been 6 years that we've been with Landmark. And now here we are talking about the sort of next venture, the next journey, part of the journey. And that's medication-assisted treatment with great clinical care. So always grateful to have you on as a guest. You and I did an episode with one of your idols, I would say. And do you mind telling the audience who that was?
Oh, yeah. I was able to have a chat with Carla DiClemente, and that was quite the experience for me. I had my fangirl moment. It was
a great episode.
I'm going to have to go back and check that out. I didn't see that.
Yeah.
But I've had that moment. I remember I was sitting in an audience, and he was on a panel, and love his work.
Yeah, the stages of change theory just was that theoretical model that just blew my mind in graduate school. So to be able to, so much of it is, what we grounded our clinical on here at Landmark, that to meet with him was definitely one of those things.
Very cool.
Well, I will formally introduce Michelle for those of you who don't know her yet. Michelle has been with Landmark Recovery since the beginning of 2016. She has been in her role as chief clinical officer since 2019. As CCO, Michelle is responsible for development and oversight of Landmark's clinical programming, as well as quality assurance and compliance. She's a licensed clinical social worker, with active licenses in Arizona, Kentucky, Ohio, Virginia, is a certified clinical trauma specialist. Michelle received her master's degree in social work from Kent School of Social Work, University of Louisville, and she brings more than 13 years of experience working with families and individuals and families healing from substance use and other co-occurring disorders. Michelle, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Glad you're here.
And she's a mom.
Yeah, she is. She is. Yeah. Got a great son. And does he, by the way, Michelle, does he still have like his, his hashtags, his Instagram stuff going on?
He does. So I, tried really hard to create this like separate identity. When I had a kid, I realized my Instagram became nothing but my son. And so I created his own Instagram, but I am too lazy to post between. So it just kind of go between. But yeah, no, the hashtag famous, the famous Seamus, I'm still trying to make it happen and trend. So.
Hello.
And I don't have to work at Landmark anymore, right? No, I'm just kidding. I love working here.
I just want to start off, Mike, and I know that you've got a bunch of questions too for Michelle. And when you first started the clinical program at Landmark, Michelle, obviously trauma, right, was a big piece of what went into your sort of thought process around developing Landmark's clinical program, at least, the exploration of trauma and how it feeds into substance use and mental health. What went into your decision-making or thought process to select this specific approach with MAT? And I want to frame that by saying, please tell us, the listeners and the audience about like, what is the overall sort of approach looking like for the MAT program at Landmark?
Yeah, well, I'll get back, probably talk about the term MAT a little bit later in our conversation.
Yeah.
But as far as our outpatient, our opioid replacement therapy program that we're kind of beta launching right now, the clinical backing that went into it. So a lot of times when we're dealing with residential care, which is what we've been doing, residential care and outpatient, maybe at the most you're getting 3 months of services that you're kind of able to pack as much as you can into that time. So when we developed our initial programming, it was really looking at brief interventions, things that could be done in a 35-day length of time and 8 weeks of IOP. So we had this very small amount of time in which we had to pack as much clinical punch as we possibly could. So with something like opioid replacement therapy, or what people know as MAT, it's kind of the umbrella term, you have a lot more runway. You have a much longer clinical program to work with. So we didn't have to look at what are the most, efficacious brief interventions. It was like, well, what is the therapy that most people would benefit from having when you've got kind of all the time in the world? You typically have a year or more where you have someone connected to services, attending services consistently in order to get that treatment. So I really had the world to work with. I personally, one of the clinical approaches the one I chose for our program, for our outpatient program, is dialectical behavior therapy. And the reason that I went with dialectical behavior therapy is it's just a fantastic clinical approach. For those that don't know, it was initially developed to treat individuals with borderline personality disorder, which for anyone working in the world of substance use disorders, they're kind of like hand in hand. So, and it's a skill-based curriculum. It looks, it's very focused on learning adaptive skills to help manage, distress tolerance, emotion regulation, increase your interpersonal effectiveness. So it's just a really fantastic clinical approach, but it's not a brief treatment, right? It's not something you can do in 35 days. Maybe you can sprinkle it in here and there. Typically, you see the mindfulness component of DBT brought into like residential programs. But in its model, it's meant to be delivered in about a year and then kind of supportive care after that. So wasn't something we could really do inpatient or in a residential setting, but definitely the setting allowed for us to do a full, true to model DBT program. So
with fidelity, as you would say, right?
Absolutely. You know, that's one of my terms, fidelity to the model in which it was
based. Yeah, no, no.
Well, music to my ears, Michelle. I you know, we haven't had that conversation, but it's such a pet peeve of mine because of so many websites say they do DBT. And, you know, they might do DBT informed.
Correct.
But they're not doing DBT because, as you said, it's specific at the length of time. And I also love, you know, the idea that, you know, 35 days inpatient and 8 weeks of outpatient is short term, because I too believe that is a brief period of time. And so many people think this 28 day light bulb is going to go off, and it's just not reality.
Well, and Zach, to kind of circle back, you know, you talked about kind of, we've always been trauma informed. Obviously trauma is being a certified trauma specialist in my career. That's something that's threaded throughout the care that we do. You know, I've worked really hard on making sure that the clinical approach that we have in our residential program is, yes, it's trauma informed, but we're not treating trauma. We are there. The goal of that residential stay in IOP is to help people identify, I have a trauma. I have a traumatic experience that's impacting my ability to function and my use of substances. That's it. Like I tell people, like, our job in the inpatient setting is to find the trauma box. Just locate it. Be able to point at it. Don't necessarily open it up. And please definitely don't start unpacking it. We don't have enough time. So it's great. This is a great natural kind of growth for our clinical program, because now we've got, okay, inpatient, we're identifying, hey, I have a traumatic experience that maybe I didn't recognize before, and I've been able to identify, there's my trauma box. IOP, we get to kind of buffer that substance use disorder element and kind of help someone gain a longer period of time away from substances, or a time where they're transitioning back into their home setting. So they're using those adaptive coping, not really touching the trauma again necessarily. And if we're in the DBT program, well, the DBT is all about, I always call it bubble wrap, right? We're like wrapping you up and all of the adaptive skills that you're going to need so that you're ready to open that trauma box in about a year. And then now that you've got all those skills, you've got all that foundation underneath you, you're ready to really start diving into what is in that box in a safe, supportive manner that reduces the risk of a significant relapse.
Got it. And similar in a lot of respects with the OBOT program, where the same approach is kind of going to be like identifying the trauma boxes. Would you say that's pretty accurate?
Yeah. It's, you know, again, DBT isn't a trauma treatment necessarily. It's about developing the skills necessary to be able to manage trauma. Most of the time in a true DBT program, which is part of our OBOT. And for those that don't know the term OBOT, an office-based opioid treatment program, we learn it. It's just our vernacular, but I'm sure people know what that is. So we'll spend that first, you know, period of time talking about the skills necessary to unpack the trauma. And then we recommend trauma treatment at that point. So we're really not diving into that trauma until maybe the year and a half mark. Once someone, if they were to come into the landmark world during detox, it might be a year and a half in that they're finally diving into that trauma, because we want it to be safe. We want them to be ready, and we want them to have the skills necessary to unpack that box.
Love it.
That brings up another question for me, Michelle. And, you know, we talked to Dr. Kirby about the lack of training around these issues in medical school. And, you know, like your perspective on training with counselors, you know, not necessarily addiction treatment counselors, but all therapists that, you know, going to be seeing people for anything from marriage and family therapy to working with their kids to, you know, so many people walking in and out of counseling offices that these issues don't get identified. They don't get referred to treatment. They don't ever get to unpack these things. And also the ability to talk to them about what treatment actually should look like so they can find appropriate care. Do you see that schools are starting to include more of this training, or is it as frustrating to you as it has been to me for the last 20 years?
I think it depends. I think perhaps the schools are trending in that direction, but not necessarily always the learners. I think sometimes people kind of come in and they want to be this like general therapist, and they want this, you know, kind of idea of, I definitely was, when I went through school, which we're not going to talk about how long ago that was, because it really ruins the illusion of being ageless and timeless. But I remember I had to pursue that specialization. My program had your track. And everyone did the track to become a social worker. And most people did that. And if you wanted to, you could kind of branch off to some of the new exploratory programs where you learned about, like, I have an alcohol and drug specialty that I pursued, but I had to be the one pursuing it. It wasn't presented to me. And if I had not done that, I would have never been exposed to it in my graduate education, which is pretty sad, seeing as 1 in 12 American adults are diagnosed with a substance use disorder. 1 in 12, but it's not a like standardized part of education of a counselor. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Right. I'm curious, you know, just in this most recent time that you finished grad school, Michelle, when you were going through your training and after you graduated and made a decision to become trauma certified, was it even popular back then? Because it seems like with the work of like Brené Brown and, you know, some of these other folks who have made trauma, you know, of course, you know, The Body Keeps the Score, you know, came about, and that really opened people's eyes to trauma and how it plays in. When you sought out this certification, was it popular then to actually go and seek that out? Was it becoming more popular? What was the sort of ethos at the time, I guess?
Gosh, that's a great question. I'm going to pretend that I remember what was going on back then. I would say, I don't think so. Because I feel like, you know, like I think about the Kaiser Permanente study, the CEO, you know, about ACEs and adverse childhood experiences. And I do not have any memory. Now, it could be like a, you know, Lord of the Rings, Gandalf the Grey situation where I'm like, I have no memory of this place, but I don't remember being introduced to ACEs as part of my graduate education. And that is to me foundational elements of trauma, you know, adverse childhood experiences, as far as I can tell, that's the building block right there. And I don't think it was part of my education.
Yeah, I know it wasn't part of my master's program. It wasn't part of my treatment program. I do remember when they started talking about ACEs, because prior to that, it seems like it was all big T. Everybody talked about the big trauma, the 9/11, the Vietnam War, and all of that stuff. And a lot of us, at least in my generation, it was like, well, that was just what happened. You know, that's right. Not trauma. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, I was taught a lot about like post-traumatic stress, and it was like, yeah, but like, that's not always, it's not always PTSD. It's, there's so many other forms of trauma. You know, I always think of, I do a lot of, obviously, is compliance. I do a lot of quality reviews of our documentation, and I see a lot of therapists who jump to that PTSD diagnosis. And I'm like, whoa, slow your roll. That's a big diagnosis to give someone. Have we considered the fact that, you know, again, this, like, I wasn't taught about adjustment disorders. I wasn't taught, you know, at the time we didn't have the DSM-5, so we didn't even have trauma-related disorders to even dive into. So it was, you know, really, I feel like I would say trauma's probably become kind of the newest topic. I want to say in the last 6 years, 7 years.
Got it.
And going off script, because you just made me think of it, Michelle, how much did the advent of that, or the acknowledgement of that, I guess, in therapy play into the idea of the OBOT program and giving people that time to heal before we start to delve into, you know, some of the things you talked about, and not trying to rush them into that as soon as they get out of treatment? We know it's difficult to do that work. And having that ability to reduce the cravings and keep them safe through that, was that a big part of putting this program together?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just in general, just the movement of the industry as a well, I say the movement of the industry, the movement, at least in our philosophical approach at Landmark, we've seen this shift of, you know, ASAM says you can't be program driven. Right? You can't just say, this is the program that we have, and if you don't fit into it, there's something wrong with you. That's not the way that we treat people. We provide individualized care because we are all individuals. What works for you, Michael, might be different than what works for Zach and what works for me, but maybe there's overlap and there's elements. So being able to have programs that fit everyone that could come into our ecosystem or anyone that we could interact with was really the driving force. I think, you know, I mean, trauma is the thread that runs throughout, I say, the world, because we just live in society. You know, that's just the nature of the beast. But it's really making sure that we have a type of a continuum of care that allows anyone to find really what they need for recovery and their definition of recovery, which is pretty controversial, I think, for us to move. We started off, you know, Zach, if you'll remember, our very early like mission statement was abstinence-based. And it was like, we are an abstinence-based program. And we no longer have that part of our mission statement because abstinence is not the same as recovery. And, you know, so that definition of what is recovery is really what has, I think, driven the OBOT program more than anything.
Yeah, and I've had that conversation with Bill White and John Kelly for so long, and I still remember the first time that Bill White really got my attention, William White, for those of you that don't know him, he said, think about recovery for everyone by any means. And that just took this this microscopic world of recovery for me and opened it up to, you know, again, who am I to say what you should do just because I did it, and look at it from what do we think is clinically and medically appropriate for you, and two, what are you willing to do? What are you looking for? And I do this presentation tomorrow on what is success, and people ask that all the time. I say, well, what's your idea of success?
Right.
I'm not the one to tell you what you should be doing.
Correct.
Well, the whole idea too, Mike, I think, you know, that I think of, and we've talked about this as well, and I think Michelle, you and I have talked about it, is this idea of having a good quality of life, right? Which is not exclusive to just being clean and abstinent, right? It's like, you know, how are you showing up in your life? Are you happy? You know, that's the thing that I kind of come back to, because you can have a tremendous amount of sobriety, right? And that's not to take anything away from being sober, because there's a lot to be said about that. But are you showing up each day where you feel like you have purpose? You know, like where you feel like you are living a life that's truly valuable to yourself and other people, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I also look at, you know, where are people coming in at? We've got people coming in a lot of different places today than when I came into a treatment center. Most people didn't experience, at least at that time, it wasn't the overdose into the emergency room, into a treatment center. And that's the path for so many today. consequently, the path out should be different because we've got, as Michelle, you said earlier, so many different kinds of people walking through the door. They're all individuals.
Yeah. You know, I guess it's so interesting to me, and it's not, because it's if you take a look at a place like Kentucky in this sort of Southeast Midwest region where the opiate epidemic has really slammed it, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of physicians, medical folk who have opened up MAT programs, right? And there's different sort of measures of success that they'll tell you that they base their, you know, outcomes on. You know, I'm curious from, you know, when you started going down the road of developing this, Michelle, what sort of measures of success did you choose to evaluate this OBOT program compared to other MAT programs?
Yeah, I mean, I think I wouldn't limit it just to the MAT program or our OBOT program. I would say it's our program in general. You know, we actually 2022, this is my main objective for my projects this year here at Landmark, is to really get our outcomes off, like out there and, you know, kind of get that measurement done and getting us kind of published by the end of the year of looking at, why is our program better? We hope it's going to be better. That's the hopeful outcome. But it's just like you said, I'm not interested in measuring consecutive days sober. I'll measure it because that's something to measure. But what I'm interested in is before you came to Landmark. So we measure when someone comes in, they complete our outcome measure. And one of the questions that we ask about is in the last 30 days, how frequently have you engaged in, you know, a list of high risk behaviors, from substance use to high risk sexual encounters to, you know, binging, purging, self-harming behaviors, excessive shopping, excessive working, like things that we would consider to be kind of high risk that impact our health negatively and impact our mental health and our physical health negatively. So how, you know, we get that baseline of measurement. And then hopefully when they're completed with the program, as they progress in our program, we see that engagement go down. We see the frequency of engagement and risk behaviors, not just substance use, but risk behaviors across the board. So that's one is, are we seeing a reduction in high risk, you know, encounters and high risk behaviors? That's one thing we want to measure to look at is has that improved? Because hopefully it has. The second thing that we look at, you kind of hit the nail on the head, is quality of life, right? Quality of life indicators. How satisfied and happy does this person feel about their relationships, their finances, their work, overall life satisfaction? Because the idea would be probably in the 30 days leading up to coming into care, it's not very good. So hopefully it's better, you know, by the time they're nearing graduation with us or as they progress in our treatment. And then one of the last areas that we're looking at is also utilization of a high cost, high intensity medical care. So things like going to the ER, taking an ambulance ride because you overdosed, or you know, kind of, and then on the flip side, engagement in lower cost, lower intensity. Right. Do we see, so we should see someone not going to the ER as much, not taking the ambulance rides as frequently, but maybe now they're going to their primary care as they should. They're getting their medications refilled on a regular basis. So they're not having to like go to urgent or ER care to kind of get their meds restarted or go into a care setting like ours, just to get back on their routine, that they're engaging in those low intensity medical services, because that to me speaks of quality of life. It speaks of self-care.
Totally.
They're taking care of themselves the way that they should. So that's what we are measuring when we talk about our outcomes.
Which also builds self-confidence and all those other things, right?
Yeah. And I'm going to go ahead. I remember like a point I wanted to make. When we talk about like quality of life, I mean, the tagline for dialectical behavior therapy is live the life, you know, like what's the life that you dreamed of living? Mm-hmm. And that's what you're always looking at with DBT, is what's a life worth living and what are the things that you need to do to achieve that?
Fantastic.
When is someone a good candidate or a good fit for the OBAT program?
Yeah, the biggest one, because I thought about this one for a bit. The biggest thing that I think they need to have is stability, meaning that they are stable in that community. Mm. They've got housing. They've got maybe employment if that's necessary to kind of fund their housing. They have supports in that community, meaning they're going to stay put and come to their appointment. So stable housing, transportation, and the supports necessary that kind of foster continued compliance. I think this a good candidate also needs to have some level of, and I this is probably one where I'm like, I kind of hate saying this out loud, but failure at other care levels. Mm-hmm. You know, not every single person who has an opioid use disorder needs to be on an opioid replacement therapy. Not they you know, again, it's a continuum. It's about finding the care that's right for you. And often we need to have previous failures to attempt abstinence or some other type of harm reduction before we say, yeah, maybe this is the next step. Mm-hmm. You know, I think an exception to that would be someone who is maybe hasn't been to treatment, but they're having frequent, unintentional overdoses. Again, they're going to the ER multiple times for these overdoses. Maybe they haven't been to treatment before, but gosh, this person's 21 years old and they're overdosing three times a week. Let's go ahead and get them stable, and maybe we don't have abstinence to begin with. So it's, you know, I mean, but I think the biggest one is that they are embedded in the community in which they will receive services.
Yep. And willing to engage in the other services that we're providing. I think that's a key piece I've seen a lot of programs miss, is that, you know, they quote the research and the efficacy, but then they design programs that don't match the research, which will provide the efficacy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of there definitely that, I think that intrinsic and internal drive for change has to be there, because it's not an easy program. A DBT program we talk about, it's like, oh, it's so great. And it's a year, and it's evidence-based, but it's intense. It's two skill groups a week. It's one individual therapy session. It is coaching calls. It's consultation team. Like, it's still a commitment to your well-being. It's, you know, I always say it's like a gym membership. You got to use it.
Well, and that's I was going to say, Michael, that's to not just the client, but also to the therapist that's truly engaging in learning DBT and practicing it, right? So there's a intensity, I think, that goes along with being a DBT therapist. Would you agree, Michelle?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I remember hearing the Marsha Linehan stories. She wasn't easily forgiving of people who didn't adhere to the program, let's say.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not doing what you're, I think the skills go very far. Like, definitely you can kind of sprinkle the skills into, you know, kind of average therapy routines, and there's some benefit there. But when you start digging into the diary cards and you're looking at that accountability angle, and you're really truly processing your target behaviors and using the skills thoughtfully, I mean, that's when you're gonna see that lasting change. It can't just be casual. It has to be intentional.
Walk us through, if you can, just, you know, you mentioned, like, for those who are listening, at least, what is a skills class look like? Or what can you talk, just give us a hint maybe of like what that might look like if I was a participant in our program, you know, like what, in terms of DBT, what would I be trying to learn or do maybe differently? Just a snippet of something.
Yeah. So I'll kind of just do a little DBT 101.
Yeah.
So DBT really has four core areas where all of the skills kind of fall into one of these categories. You have a mindfulness kind of, I say, domain. This is focused on improving an individual's ability to kind of accept and be present in the current moment. So it's about being able to accept, hey, this is life right now, and I can kind of live in this moment without having to change it. Then you have distress tolerance. This is focused on increasing an individual's tolerance of negative emotions or situations. So rather than attempting to escape, we can kind of sit in crisis and be okay with it. Go, I can handle this distressful feeling today. So there's skills that are focused on increasing someone's ability to do that. Emotion regulation, which covers strategies to manage and change intense emotions. So a lot of times people struggle to regulate their emotional states, and that's what creates kind of negative coping strategies. And then the last domain is interpersonal effectiveness. This is really teaching someone techniques that improve communication. So helping someone learn how to communicate with others in a way that's assertive, that maintains self-respect, and then strengthens relationships. So when we talk about those four domains coming into our groups and our skill groups, is you have two sessions of group per week. So every week is a particular domain. So within that domain, so 1 week would be mindfulness, 1 week would be interpersonal effectiveness. And we've kind of rotated them. So there's, you know, you have 1 week as mindfulness. So out of the month, you'll have a week on each of the domains. And from there, there's probably 6 to 12 skills within the mindfulness domain itself, you know, things like mindful eating, attention to breath, things like that. So we, during skill group one, we're teaching that skill. So this is, you know, mindful eating, and we're demonstrating it, and we're teaching that. Then between those sessions, you'll have an individual session where your individual therapist is able to go, hey, you did mindful eating this week. Have you practiced this? Let's double down. Let's kind of dive back into that. Make sure you really are practicing it. And then the second skill group dives a layer deeper and says, okay, now that you've had the week to practice, you've learned about mindful eating, you've practiced mindful eating. Now let's talk about, how did it work? Did you have an experience where you were able to apply it in a real setting where you had a distressful emotion that you wanted to manage, or a distressful situation? Let's look at how it worked out. And so that's how our skills groups are built. So you've got two a week, one that introduces it, one that talks about how did you apply it, and what can we do to reinforce it, so that we're really digging into those.
Awesome. Well, you know, I guess in terms of the last question I would have would be in terms of like a time frame for people to be in this program. I think you were, from what I can understand, you're pretty intentional about the time frame. Can you talk a little bit more about that and what people can expect?
Yeah. I mean, obviously asking someone to commit to a year of, you know, two groups a week plus an individual session is a lot. It sounds like a lot. In reality, it's not a lot if you really think about it. But we do, you know, the best evidence is that year's worth of behavioral health treatment. So sure. The target is for everyone to complete at least 1 year. So as they're coming to receive their, you know, medication for opioid replacement therapy, they're, for that first year, at least they're engaging in this behavioral health component as well. You know, how rigid we'll be on that is yet to be determined. We kind of want what we want. I wouldn't want someone to not participate just because they're like, well, that's a lot of therapy. Well, yes, it is. But you did a lot of stuff to support your addiction too. So let's really, talk about that. And then at that point, I don't know what's going to happen where this is brand new. We have individuals who are on opioid replacement therapy for multiple years. At that year mark might be ready to start to explore coming off of that medication. It's right. Not a prerequisite. You don't have to come off of it, although that could be a goal for someone. And then once that's done, you know, what we would like to work on next is to build out. So we've identified the trauma box. We've buffered the trauma, you know, prepared the person to go into to trauma processing. And then now let's look at once they've kind of stabilized on their medication, they've learned enough adaptive coping through their DBT engagement. Hey, now let's get you into a trauma processing like program of some type, which would be the next phase of this care, so that we would be able to help them through that trauma processing as well and any extended care that they needed to have.
Fantastic.
It sounds like you've really put together a program. I know a lot of the concern out there from a lot of people in the recovery community, if you will, is the difference between medication-assisted treatment and medication as treatment. And I think that the big concern I've heard for 10, 12 years from a lot of physicians and therapists is those programs that are opening up medication as treatment. And it really sounds like you've got a solid medication-assisted treatment program here. And I'm looking forward to seeing the results.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always, my view on any type of medication, when we're talking about medication-assisted treatment, I mean, taking, an antidepressant, like an SSRI, is medication-assisted treatment. It's the thing that's necessary. I always think of therapy as being effective when you can reach it. But what if therapy is out of reach because it's on the top shelf of your kitchen and you're not quite tall enough yet to reach that shelf? So you got medications, that like stool that we put out. We go, okay, step on this. Now you can get therapy to work. And at some point, you know, perhaps you'll be tall enough to reach that shelf without this step, or maybe this step will be there for kind of as long as you need it to be there.
Exactly. Great.
Well, Michael, Michelle, this is always, you know, just a great interview. I mean, this is a great topic to talk about. And I just want to thank everybody for listening. You know, we drop a new episode every Tuesday. So Michelle, thank you so much for being a part of this show.
Yeah. And if you're out there and you want to like and subscribe, if you miss an episode, go back and see them. I obviously missed the one that we referred to with Michelle on earlier, so I'm going to go back and watch that. And please leave us a review. Zach and I need we need the constructive criticism, and we also need the accolades. So thanks, everyone.
Be well.
Thank you for tuning in to Recovery Radio. New content for this program is available every Tuesday at 12 noon Eastern Time and 9 a.m. Pacific Time, with all episodes available on demand on the Voice America Health and Wellness channel and through our content partners, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play Podcasts. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review so we can continue to create quality content to help save 1 million lives in the next 100 years. You don't need to struggle through addiction alone. Live the life you dreamed on the road to recovery.